K. Jackson, Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, a Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. The Washington Post's owner is talking about the choice not to endorse a presidential candidate this year. More from CBS's Peter King.
In an op-ed piece in the Post, Jeff Bezos writes that in a business based on credibility, endorsement creates a perception of bias and non-independence.
Former President Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from New York City rally comments a comedian made about Puerto Rico. At the same time, during a campaign stop in Atlanta, he's pouring cold water on accusations by critics that he would be an authoritarian American leader.
I'm not a Nazi. I'm the opposite of a Nazi. I don't know.
Israel passes legislation prohibiting the United Nations agency providing humanitarian aid to Gaza from operating on Israeli soil. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
We continue to urge the government of Israel to pause the implementation of this legislation. We urge them not to pass it at all.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Comedian, journalist, and fellow Midwesterner Charlie Behrens is bringing a live episode of his Kripescast podcast to the Vivarium on October 29th, presented by 540 WAUK and Civic Media. He'll be joined by Dan Schaefer, Civic Media political editor and founder of the Recombobulation Area, to talk about why your vote is essential to keep removing this November. Charlie provides the punchlines while Dan breaks down the key ballot issues. Proceeds from the event will benefit the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Tickets on sale now at PabstTheaterGroup.com.
For 540 WAUK News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A trial date of November 8th has been set for the 23-year-old man accused of fatally shooting a UW Whitewater gymnast. Chad Richards will face trial next month for the death of Kara Welsh. Welsh, a 21-year-old management major and national vault champion, was killed August 30th in an apartment near campus. Richards, who was Welsh's boyfriend, faces charges of first-degree intentional homicide with the use of a dangerous weapon. The campaign blitz continues today in Wisconsin. Vice presidential candidates Tim Walz and J.D. Vance are making multiple stops, followed by Vice President Harris and former President Trump holding rallies on Wednesday. Trump has a two-stop strategy, including a Friday event in Milwaukee at the Fiserv. There was a photo op in the Fox Valley this weekend. Lisa Hale has more.
U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg was in Oshkosh Saturday drumming up support for the Democratic ticket and invigorating Canvas volunteers.
Communities red, blue, and purple already understand that if we're serious about protecting children in school, that's not about keeping a Toni Morrison paperback out of the school library. It's about making sure assault weapons don't get anywhere near the school.
Buttigieg also spoke in Green Bay, Appleton, and Fond du Lac Saturday.
A hit-and-run incident linked to illegal street racing has left a Bayview bartender fighting for her life. The impact, which took place Saturday night near the Wiggle Room where Kara Corder worked, has drawn attention to the neighborhood's ongoing struggles with dangerous driving. A federal judge has handed down a 4-month prison sentence to a former Waukesha County Sheriff's Lieutenant. 34-year-old Joanna Grace will serve time for smuggling marijuana and a cell phone into the jail. The sentencing...
for being here today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about... Democracy dies in darkness. That is the punchline for the Washington Post. Democracy dies in darkness. They are supposed to be the light. They are supposed to be the ones that share the information. They're supposed to be a trusted source. So when, you know, all of the people in the entire institution say, hey, we're going to endorse Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, and upper management, you know, the bean counters, the folks at the top go, no. It kind of makes you wonder. Kind of makes you wonder what it is that made the Washington Post bow on the bent knee to Donald Trump. Now, there could be a thousand reasons. It's the same argument that I make about Sean O'Brien bending his knee to Donald Trump as well. Could it be fear of retribution? Could it be promise of something greater? Could it be, who knows? But done got. And it's one of those moments where you go, what is it? Now, the general consensus on the Washington Post is that Bezos in 2016 lost a major defense contract. Billions of dollars. So didn't want to get on the wrong side of Trump. And understand that. Understand a guy who tells us he wants to be dictator. Understand a guy who demonizes journalism. You know, attacks journalists, I can see why you would be afraid to come out against them. Look, I understand when I speak out against power and they attempt to come after me, I get that. Not my first rodeo. But when you're talking about billions of dollars, I think that speaks pretty loudly. And when you have a, I would argue Amazon, Blue Origin, those are the keys. I would assume that the Washington Post, kind of just a hobby for Bezos. Why he owns it, I think, is part of the structure of building the wealth. Clearly, Amazon does a lot of advertising. It could feed into feeding the paper, thus, you know, giving you the advantage of having another outlet to promote your products, to promote your ideas, to gain additional power. I get it. I absolutely get it. But here's the weird thing. In the same publication, in the same Washington Post, they had an article that basically asked you, and you could take a quiz to find out where you were politically on who you would support in the election. And it had a whole bunch of issues that they went through, and you were able to gauge from 1 to 5 how important, you know, abortion and guns and jobs and immigration and all this stuff. You were able to find out where you were and how important it was to you. And what they came up with is that the majority of the country, by a large swath, was in favor of the policies of Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and not so much Donald Trump. So again, there's a lot of evidence going, you know, it would be better for the country. It would be better for the economy. It'd be better for working people if we went in this direction, which I think is why they didn't do it. And it makes me think that, you know, this is why I've been talking about a media structure owned by the public, a media structure that has some balance. I know there are some people who say we should bring back the fairness doctrine. In this day and age, it's not possible. What has to happen is you have to invest in a balance. And I was reading a story that a friend of mine had written on his Facebook page. You know, we go back years. We're both old labor guys. And he was talking about, you know, the situation between Nippon Steel and U.S. Steel and how, you know, Nippon is spending a ton of money, you know, influencing how people think about. But how this, you know, my friend was explaining to someone, you know, how it would actually work for workers, how it would be for communities, and how the messaging, the message that the steel workers and the union has is actually much, much better for working people. Their wants, their needs, their ideas, far superior to what's being sold, but it doesn't get out there. And it's the reason that corporate America, you know, spends gazillions of dollars on messaging. And what he wrote in his post, which, you know, again, is quite poignant and to the point. He had a conversation with somebody and he said, you know, what I got out of this was there's still a lot of confusion over what's happening and people are plugged in and receptive to our message. And those conversations can happen in unlikely places. He was coming out of surgery when he had a conversation over this. And I've been saying for years, there has to be some balance. And to bring it back to what I do here. You know, over 19 years ago, we started this little program as a way to add some balance, to put out an alternative message of working voices. Instead of all corporate, all profit, all what can you buy from me? Our goal was to talk about working class issues. And I've had people say, well, you're a news program. No, I'm not a news. I'm an information person. I'm going to give you what I think is important, and I'm going to give you why I think it's important, and it's for you to filter through. You agree with me, you disagree with me, great. That's a conversation point. We don't do enough of this. You know, I had a conversation with a nurse at the hospital, and, you know, he said, you know, you're one of the first people I've talked about politics with who I don't want to strangle at the end. And I said, no, because it's a conversation. I learn as much from you as you might learn from me. And that's what we need to be doing. We don't have that today. What we've got is an extraordinarily powerful corporate media. 80% of everything we see, hear, and read is owned by a handful of people. a handful of corporate interests, Jeff Bezos at the top of it, Elon Musk owning Twitter. What working class media is out there that talks about what's important to working people? And I find it interesting that so many workers that I talk to, so many of my coworkers and my friends, believe so much that isn't true. Donald Trump is never going to be a friend of working people. He's got a lifetime of stiffing over workers. He's got a lifetime of trying to cheat workers out of wages, to crush costs, because that's what business people do. This idea that somehow he's on our side is quite comical. But I can't laugh because it's dangerous. This is a guy who, when he was president, was horrible for working people. His policies were terrible. They were great, great for the wealthy. And they will be great again. But you got to ask yourself, when you see the kind of wealth that was accumulated because of the pandemic and because of the tax bill, which side are you on? It's easy to see today a billionaire like Elon Musk out there pimping Donald Trump. It's easy to see the billions of dollars that are being spent to get him elected. And you have to ask why. Which side is he on? Which side is he going to support and fight for? I think it's clear. A guy who has a concept of a plan, doesn't have a healthcare plan, doesn't have a jobs plan. It's all about tearing down, demeaning. It's about fear and smear. And yet we've got a newspaper, or Los Angeles Times too, failing to endorse in a moment where we need courage. We need actual information. We don't need fear and smear. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, yeah, I got to tell you, I love the latest Trumpery. We've been talking about his bizarre patterns of speech, his rambling sentence fragmented speech that, just seems to be wandering all over the place. You don't know where he's going, where he's been, what he's up to, nothing. You have no idea where this word salad journey is going to take you. But evidently, he says this is on purpose. He has named his rambling sentence fragmented speech as the weave. He claims to weave, you need an extraordinary memory to get back where you started. And I couldn't help but think, this is the tactic that used car salesmen use. They use it all the time. They get you all confused and all discombobulated to sell you a giant lemon. Is that what he's doing? Or is he just losing his mind? Here to share some thoughts on, all of that and a whole lot more, I've asked my good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts. Sarah's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website, if you want to take a look at her work. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how the heck are you?
The weave, Sarah, the weave.
It's like, tell me that you don't have any black women in your life without telling me that you don't have any black women in your life, right? Like, the second he said weave, I was like, I'm pretty sure that's not the way that works. weave usually takes, like, you know, definitely at least 3 hours, right? Like,
wouldn't know. I have no idea. But here's the weird thing. I've seen this now in a couple of places. The Washington Post, for instance, this is with the article where I read it. The Washington Post is putting this in it. And I'm going, will this now be the justification for idle ramblings? Whereas when it was Joe Biden who was going on these journeys, it was dementia. Now it's the weave.
Like, you name it and somehow that makes it acceptable. But the thing is like, we've been, for people like us who've watched him nonstop since 2015, you can tell the difference. Like, you really can see how he has changed over the years and how he's declined. Yeah. And I think even folks like, you know, Maggie Haberman and people who are in that circle of people that he speaks to, either for interviews or whatever, they've made it pretty clear, like, he is not anywhere near where he was, you know, when he first came into office. He sure as heck isn't anywhere near where he was when he was younger. And there was a campaign ad that he put on True Social last week. And they put all of these old clips of him talking throughout the 80s and 90s. And I was like, God, this really, he sounds much more articulate. And so to me, it just emphasizes how different he is with, you know, this young person who seems to know what's happening in the world versus where he is now, where it's just a hodgepodge of nothingness.
Yeah, just sentence fragments of you know, one dumb idea after another. And as you pointed out in one of your articles, a speech about windmills, rabbits, and Pocahontas, that's popped up.
And it's, what's sad about it is, and a couple of people made this connection, is that old book by John Steinbeck of Mice and Men with the guy who's, you know, a little slow, who can't stop petting the rabbits, you know, but he pets them too hard and then he breaks their necks. And at the end of the book, he, spoiler alert, he, you know, he ends up breaking this girl's neck. And so it's like, it kind of makes you think of Trump, like, you know, is he going to kill us all? Maybe.
Thanks for that.
World War III. I know, right? That. Kind of a downer.
But the weird thing is look, you know, everyone knows that he's losing his mind. You've got ex-aides, you know, saying, you know, Trump's, you know, bizarre, you know, saying ridiculous things, doing this kind of stuff. You've got a mainstream media that's ignoring it. The Washington Post, the LA Times, not endorsing anyone, you know, following Sean O'Brien and the Teamsters, which brings up a whole bunch of questions about either what they've got on the Washington Post and the LA Times, or are they scared to death? I don't know, but it brings up a lot of questions.
It does. And I could go either way on this, like, where my first initial reaction was they are thinking that this is a business decision where they think that, you know, by placating to Trump, if he is reelected, then they won't, you know, put all of their reporters in camps or whatever.
Yeah, he's not going to continue to go after reporters and mock them and highlight them as the enemy. No, he won't do that anymore. He promises. He pinky swears.
Yeah. That's the thing. And he, you know, I think I get if you wanted to appeal to a larger audience. I honestly don't believe that newspapers should be endorsing candidates at all. And so I understand this idea of the Post wants to go back to an era where they didn't do that. I don't think that it's smart to start necessarily with one of the most important elections of our life, the most important election.
Especially Sarah, when your tagline is
democracy dies in darkness.
Yeah. I mean, when that's your, when I get the Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, perfectly get that. But when your statement is democracy dies in darkness and you're leading us into darkness.
And the thing is, you know, about, when you think about the business piece of this, which I can completely understand if he wants to appeal to more people, the problem is that the majority of their subscribers are coming from a group that came in after 2016 and they wanted to see all of the Trump coverage, right? And they haven't had, I mean, Joe Biden is really boring. So there's not a lot of scandal and, like, oh my God, that they can report on.
Right.
So in terms of a business thing, like if you have a majority of your subscribers are coming from the left, I mean, what are you thinking by making it into this huge thing where you're not going to endorse Harris over Trump? And I mean, from what I heard from somebody was something like 60,000 people unsubscribed from the post in 24 hours.
Yeah, see, I disagree with that, Sarah, because it wasn't the writers, it wasn't the people doing the jobs. This was the owners. This was the people at the top. This was the head office who don't care about those workers at the bottom. Because I don't even think it was about the Washington Post. I think it was about something much bigger than that. I think Bezos, again, somebody got, and you know, Bezos learned from 2016 and didn't get the cloud computing defense contract that Trump awarded. That was worth like $10 billion. I don't think he cares about 60,000 subscribers. I think Bezos and that ilk, I think they've got much bigger fish to fry. And whatever Trump has sold them, I think they bought.
I guess his lobbyist or like somebody on his campaign staff met with the lobbyist for the,
Blue Origin.
Met with the Blue Origin lobbyist like the day before Bezos said, we're not endorsing.
Kind of got to wonder.
I know.
And this is why that you shouldn't have newspapers owned by gazillionaires. This is why this shouldn't, information should not be in the purview of the extraordinarily wealthy who want more power. I don't know. Bezos and Musk owning two very powerful media type outlets, social media and print outlets. I don't know. I think that's a bad place to be.
I do too. But I hate the idea that journalism is a business, right? Like that to me, it means that they are making decisions on reporting in a business way, right? And we've talked about this because I get so hacked off.
We're in a clickbait world, Sarah.
Yeah. And I mean, I will rail against Bob Woodward until the cows come home because he didn't tell us about, you know, what Trump said in March of 2020 about COVID. Because that, again, was a financial decision on his part. Like, this is going to sell my book. Versus it could also save a million people's lives. And so it's so frustrating to me, you know, and I don't know how you make it right where it's either it's a nonprofit or some sort of, you know, something, but then you're talking about being beholden to donors. And it's like, I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah.
But I just know that the way it's working now just seems so disingenuous.
No, I don't either. Maybe it's publicly owned. You know, maybe it's you know, there's got to be a way to make sure our information is not biased for billionaires. Just kind of a thought thrown out there. Because, again, I come back to the Reagan quote of, you know, of knowing so much that isn't true. And, you know, I look at someone like Trump who a lot of the messages, oh, they're pro-military. I got Sean O'Brien running out there saying that Josh Hawley and J.D. Vance are pro-worker. I don't get it. But this idea that somehow Trump is pro-military, and then you see this story coming out of Arlington, you see the story with John Kelly, you see the story of this soldier that I guess we were going to pay for the funeral costs, we weren't going to pay for the funeral costs, we said some horrible things. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, so what dropped this week at The Atlantic was a little bit more about, you know, Trump's horrible things that he said about members of the military. And the key piece of it for me, I mean, this was all the whole story that really everybody was talking about was, oh, he was glorifying Hitler and talking about, you know, all of the stuff that he's already said. The thing that killed me is, you know, he had promised the families of it was a woman at Fort Hood who was murdered by this dude that was her superior, and she was dealing with a lot of sexual harassment, and he was worried that she was going to report him, and he basically beat the hell out of her and dismembered her and set her on fire. And Trump brought these people to the White House and said, you know what, if you need help, like we'll help you with the funeral costs for something like this. Like, absolutely, I'm there. And then he got the bill in the mail, and it was $60,000. And he goes, why the hell does it cost $60,000 to bury a Mexican? Just like, wow, this guy. And the John Kelly story, I mean, there were a lot of John Kelly stories that dropped where he talked about, you know, again, Trump being a fascist and yada yada. But the story that blew me away was that story of when they were in Arlington and Trump was looking at the graves and said, you know, what did they get out of this? What was this all for? That moment, Trump and John Kelly were standing over the grave of John Kelly's son. And again, this is just like, what the hell are you doing, man?
Yeah, see, this is where, you know, I got to be honest. I lose a little bit of respect for John Kelly, because I'll be honest, I don't care who you are, and people, you know, friends know me. I'm very much a man of my word. You say something like that over the grave of my dead son, you're going to be laying next to him.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing I found also about John Kelly is one of his aides said that I think that he would have come back to the White House during COVID because he was so freaked out about what Trump was doing to the country. So it's one of those things where you're like, I can see him making a very conscious decision not to sock his lights out, you know, because
I don't have that kind of, I don't have that kind of self-control.
I don't know how you do. The same story, it was an aide who saw John Kelly afterwards, and he was at Arlington putting flags on the graves of some of his former colleagues, and he was with his 5-year-old son, and Kelly wouldn't talk about what happened just before that. And his 5-year-old, the guy's 5-year-old son grabbed John Kelly's hand and said, "Do you want to say a prayer with me?" over his son's grave. And you're just like, God, from the mouths of babes, right?
If that doesn't bring tears to your eyes, and also hope that there might be a future post-Trump. And this is where, look, yeah. I've been saying this a lot since, you know, my wife was involved in the motorcycle accident that she's recovering from. You know, people have been very gracious, very kind, very nice, very thoughtful, all of that, you know, thoughts and prayers, vibes, good juju, whatever. We're getting a lot of those sentiments. So it tells me there's still as bad as we think things can be, there's something that can unite us. We just have to find what it is. And I don't want it to be tragedy. I don't want it to be the horrible. But unfortunately, you know, the more we hear about Trump, the more we hear the things that he does, the more I'm hoping something's going on in people's heads going, yeah, this isn't where we want to be. This isn't who we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I keep telling you over and over, the thing that always gets me is the thing from Mr. Rogers, where he said, when terrible things happen, look for the helpers, because the helpers are always there. The problem is a terrible thing has to happen. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's the hard part here. And hopefully, you know, come next Tuesday, we make the right choice. That's just my thought. Now, interesting bit. I keep hearing about, again, you know, if Trump wins, there's some talk he might not be able to pass a background check.
So, yes and no. The thing is that if you are the president, you automatically are given, you know, clearance to everything that you want.
Should and you?
Right? I mean, that is a little bit, right? Like, you stole classified documents and were on trial for it. And now, you know, the cancellation of that trial is being appealed at the 11th Circuit.
Right.
Like, I think there's enough information here for us to perhaps pause. But yeah, it will be automatically given to him regardless of any of his problems, of which there are many, not just the classified documents, but his relationships with foreign leaders and at all.
All right, well, we'll see. I gotta tell you, there's got to be a point in which you go, look what he did before. But I guess, again, that's on us to make sure that he doesn't get back in there to get there. So lastly, Halloween's on its way. Musk is dressing up as a human, I guess, out there doing campaign events. Going to be back in Harrisburg here, I guess, some point in the next couple of days, handing out checks. But I guess he could get himself in a little trouble over that political stunt, over that stunt he pulled.
Yeah, that's one of his problems, is that the law says that you can't pay somebody or give a gift to somebody to incentivize them to register to vote or to vote. And so the Justice Department sent him a little warning letter, which generally is also the DOJ saying, congratulations, you're now under investigation. But the DOJ doesn't confirm whether or not there is an investigation.
Or deny.
Or any other information about it. So, I mean, it may very well be that he is going to end up having to pay a whole heck of a lot of money for the cash that he's handing out.
He doesn't care. He'll just take it from his workers.
Yeah, right.
You know, the ones that he'll fire if they go on strike. Again, thank you, Sean O'Brien. But Sarah, I appreciate the time. As always, great work. I hope folks will check out the website, RawStory. RawStory.com is where you go to find Sarah Burris's work. Sarah, thanks so much.
Have an awesome week, everyone.
As always, good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Would you like to see Elon in a jumpsuit? Orange stripes? On a chain gang swinging a sickle? I want to know. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Your new choice. Real news. Great conversation. 540 WAUK.
This is your hometown radio. Refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, low in the upper 50s, maybe a storm. And a mix of sun and clouds and staying mild tomorrow, high around 80. Showers and maybe even a rumble of thunder and breezy on Wednesday. High to the upper 70s. Much colder on Thursday. Currently 57 degrees.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, according to Accountable.us, Donald Trump's signature tax law really is only legislative accomplishment. That has won 15 of America's largest corporations a massive windfall. In fact, so massive that they were able to collectively spend about $839 billion on stock buybacks and shareholder dividends in the years since the passage, doing exactly what it was meant to do. Did you get $839 billion? I don't think I did. In fact, I'm struggling like everybody else. And here to share some thoughts on what the tax policies of each candidate look like. I've asked Joe Hughes to come talk with us. Joe is a senior policy analyst there at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. They've got a new in-depth analysis of the tax proposal announced by Vice President Kamala Harris. And we're going to find out what that does for us. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I look at this, Trump's tax law, massive windfall for the very wealthy. Kamala Harris has got a plan. Walk me through some of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So just some background here. Our organization, we're a nonpartisan research group. We look at different proposals to change the tax code. And so we looked at the two major parties' candidates' tax proposals, and we found pretty stark contrast in the distributional effect across income levels. So if all of the proposals that former President Trump is proposing are enacted, they would raise taxes on average for everyone outside of the top 5% of the income distribution. So that means that unless you're making more than $360,000 a year, you're likely to see your taxes go up. And for the proposals from the Harris campaign, we found nearly the opposite effect. Her policies would cut taxes on average for the bottom 99% of families, but raise them on the top 1%.
Now, I look at this and, this This tax situation has been going on for a very long time, where we have given so much to the very wealthy in the hopes that eventually it trickles down to the rest of us. I think we've learned the lesson that that doesn't work. So for me, a tax policy that's going to say, you know what, for those who we've given so much, we should be expecting more. This is a step in the right direction. Although I got to be honest, I don't think it's a big enough step.
Yeah, we would certainly agree with that. Other organizations have found that her policies would still increase the deficit, even with the big tax cuts on the top 1%, or the top tax raises on the top 1%. And yeah, there are certainly more opportunities to go further and ensure that the wealthiest, the most well-off, are paying into the society that has allowed them to profit so much.
And while, look, I'm going to beat up on her plan a little bit, that I don't think it goes far enough. I understand the political realities of the world in which we live in. But I also know that the Trump tax plan has given the wealthy wild ability to buy, well, almost $1 trillion in stock buybacks. And what I would argue is a massive redistribution of wealth from what should be better wages, better benefits, better investments into just the wealth class lining their pockets.
Yeah, absolutely. And stock buybacks, whenever a company carries out stock buybacks, and there are sometimes certain economic reasons why it does make sense for the benefit of the company. But in general, when a company is carrying out these massive stock buyback programs year after year, that is an admission from the corporation that they don't have profitable investments to make within their own company. So they're just going to give those profits back to shareholders and to their CEOs and executives.
Yeah, I mean, the admission, we don't know what else to do with it but line our pockets. Whereas in the past, and help me if you think I'm wrong, back when these weren't legal, that profit was what unions used to negotiate for better wages, better benefits, shorter hours, better working conditions, you know, better economic, you know, conditions across the economy. It was spent a lot differently, I would argue.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to consider is that there are two primary ways that a company can return their excess profits to their shareholders. One is through stock buybacks, which we're discussing now. The other is through dividend issuances. And dividends are taxed. They're not taxed as high as your normal income that you make from wages or salaries normally, but they are taxed. And now, for a long time, buybacks were not taxed at all. Now there's a very small 1% excise tax on buybacks. But there's this massive tax differential where shareholders are much better off from a company issuing stock buybacks than issuing dividends. Yeah. And so that is a major concern, is that we should do whatever we can to equalize the rate, the tax rate, on stock buybacks and dividends.
And I would argue the Trump tax code made work even more less advantageous, as we're taxing work at a higher level than we're taxing gambling. And this push towards, you know, everyone being an independent contractor, gig employee, this kind of move away from traditional employment in the tax code towards, well, you being your own boss or being vulnerable to somebody else. That seems to be part of this as well, no?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that there are, in his new proposals, including things like exempting tip income from taxes and payroll taxes, exempting overtime income, there are just these continued distortions of the types of income that people receive, taxing it differently. And there's no good economic reason that we should tax different types of income differently.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, since you brought that up, you know, the tipped minimum wage is, you know, something that I've argued we should be doing away with. I mean, the fact that you can $2.13 an hour, I'm sorry, that's not worth someone showing up for. And I understand that tips are supposed to make it up to the minimum wage, but we know there's a lot of abuse in that system. By saying we're not going to tax the tips, I don't know that many of the people who are working for tips are paying taxes at the federal level on those tips anyway, because their income isn't sufficient generally to make it to that threshold to pay federal tax, as we learned from Mitt Romney back in 2012.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. you hit the nail on the head. Now, Harris and Trump have both proposed to exempt tips from regular income taxes. Trump goes further in exempting tips from payroll taxes as well, and also exempts overtime from income and payroll taxes. But no, it's definitely not the best way to help low and middle income workers. We have policies, like you mentioned, increasing the minimum wage for tip workers. Beyond that, we have policies that already exist in the tax code that are supposed to help these very households. We have the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, that have a huge effect on the after-tax income of low and middle income families. And these are better from just a neutral economics perspective, in that they help households based on income level, not based on the particular job that somebody is doing, right? Like, there's no good reason that we should across the board exempt certain types of workers from income taxes. Why should a teacher or a nurse, for example, pay higher income taxes than a bartender on the same amount of income?
Right.
And that's not to belittle bartenders. I was a bartender before I took this job myself. We all work in those jobs at some point in our lives. But the other problem is that we need to have very, very strict guardrails to prevent abuse. Because like you said, a lot of these workers are already not paying high income taxes, they're paying income taxes at all.
And getting cheated out of those tips as well.
Right.
You know, I look at this and I said when Trump first came out with this, I go, well, I guess now we're going to start seeing CEOs claiming that the money that they get are tipped wages. Because will we not then start heading in that direction to where, well, we're just going to start tipping people? And ultimately, and I know that sounds kind of ludicrous, but when you think about it the way I do, that this proposal by Trump is really about to destroy the whole system. Take down Social Security, take down the tax system, take down Medicare, all of that. Because once you stop taxing this stuff and you start changing how people are paid, they're not paying into these institutions and these programs that we've set up that are dependent on it. So the whole house falls down.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Exempting tips and overtime from payroll taxes, as Trump has proposed, it does have that back end effect of potentially lowering someone's future Social Security benefits, because an individual's benefits are partially tied to the payroll taxes that they pay throughout their life. So exempting that income could lead to a less stable retirement. And you mentioned the abuse that could happen with CEOs or hedge fund managers reclassifying some portion of their income as tips. You can say the same thing for overtime work, where, you know, there are many lawyers who do genuinely work 50, 60, 70 hours a week. So now they have an incentive to reclassify themselves as wage employees, and all of that extra income past 40 hours is going to be non-taxable overtime work.
Now, I have less concern about that. I guess from the lawyer, the example you gave is probably more accurate of what will happen. I know Donald Trump doesn't like overtime. In fact, he said it during his business years. He was cheating people out of overtime. So the idea of not taxing overtime doesn't seem all that problematic for me, because he doesn't want you to get overtime. And as talking about, if you look at Project 2025, changing the overtime rules so that you probably are never going to get it anyway. So not taxing it doesn't seem to be all that problematic to me.
Right. I am a tax expert, not a labor expert. So I'm not exactly sure what the Project 2025 proposals for overtime work are. But
yeah, they're bad. It's the monthly overtime instead of weekly. We're going to have a 160-hour month. So if we work you 160 hours in a week, as long as we don't work you the rest of the month, don't worry about that overtime.
Right. Yeah, no, that's definitely problematic combined with the proposal to exempt overtime from taxes. I do think that there is a genuine concern with both tips and overtime, that there have to be very, very strict definitions of what are the industries where this can be exempted, and what is the amount of income that can be exempted as well. Otherwise, it's just going to be ripe for abuse. And we've seen for so many years that the well-off have armies of accountants and lawyers, and they can find ways to change their income and avoid taxes.
There is always a loophole to be found and lobbied for. And look, I honestly, just between you, me, and the four walls, I don't believe Trump actually believes a word of this. I don't believe there's any policy behind it. I think this was word salad that just came up. The not taxing tips was something he said in Las Vegas, because in Las Vegas, there are a lot of tipped employees. The Culinary Workers Union there is very powerful, and this is an issue that is near and dear to their heart on where you set that tip line. So this just seemed to me not a matter of policy, just a matter of politic. And that's my problem with a lot of this stuff, because there's a lot of these bad ideas being thrown around without actually talking about how do we ensure that working people make a decent wage? How do we make sure that our tax system is fair and that we're able to fund the things that we need to and get the revenue we need? And I look at the Trump tax plan, massive deficits, and going forward, even larger deficits if it is to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Harris also proposed or introduced her proposal to exempt tips from income in Nevada. Big swing state with a lot of tipped workers there.
Yep.
But
also no, to put part of it into the talking about a living wage and not just the bare minimum. So her plan went a little bit further in ensuring that, you know, maybe you can actually make a living on doing the kind of service sector work that a lot of these folks do. And as I've said a million times, I'm a supporter of whatever work you do to get by, it should be enough to put a roof over your head and food on your table.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree completely. And the other problem with Trump's proposal is that we have to put it into context of his entire tax agenda, which, again, going back to what we initially talked about, would raise taxes on average for 95% of households, for the bottom 95% of households.
Walk me through how that's possible. What's going to trigger that?
Right. No. So the tax increases are largely through his proposal for a blanket 20% tariff on imports and an increased tariff of 60% on goods imported from China. So under no uncertain terms, that's going to increase prices on many goods and therefore should be seen as a consumption tax. And in fact, even Grover Norquist has said in the past, tariffs are taxes. And so the impact that ITEP and many others have found is that the tax increase for an average family would be about $4,000.
Which is sizable. And look, I'm not reactionary and I'm not against tariffs as a whole. There are certain strategic ways to use tariffs to ensure that we protect domestic interests, especially when you're talking about national security, steel, and some of our productive capacity. I do think we need to take a little bit more protective role in, but I don't know about T-shirts and tennis shoes and the rest. I'm not quite with the blanket tariff idea.
Right, absolutely. And I'm not a trade expert either, but there are certain things beyond T-shirts and tennis shoes too. There's the other factor of there are certain things that just cannot be produced in the U.S. We're never, no matter how high the tariff is, we're never going to have enough banana farms in the U.S. to supply U.S. people with bananas. We don't have manganese deposits in the U.S., which is a critical mineral for a lot of batteries and electronics. We don't have deposits of that in the U.S. So no matter how high the tariffs are, those are things that are not going to be produced in the U.S.
And that's why it's called trade and not just buying things that used to be made here from somewhere else. Right. And that's a whole nother long discussion. So last line of questioning I've got for you here, because, again, you guys put these tax plans next to each other. You guys analyze both sides of it. I know you're nonpartisan. I know you're not into the political part of this, but dollars and cents, money in my pocket, which plan works better for me?
Well, assuming that you make less than $360,000 a year.
Way less.
The Harris plan is likely to benefit you more than the Trump plan. Plain and simple.
I shouldn't be surprised. If you want to check out more of the work that Joe and his organization does, go to their website, itep.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Joe, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts. Good conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Joe Hughes, Senior Policy Analyst there at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? Does it matter that, you know, they've sold us this bill of goods that if we don't tax the rich, it'll all trickle down to us somehow, and then we'll all be able to swim in rivers of gold and honey? Or are you tired of getting stiffed? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day that the St. Louis Gateway Arch was completed in St. Louis. The project was the result of a nationwide design competition. The arch soars 630 feet above the ground and is the highest monument in the United States. The arch was made from 900 tons of stainless steel. It was meant to symbolize St. Louis's role as gateway to Western expansion. The groundbreaking ceremony for the project was held in 1959. Workers from multiple unions were involved in building the arch. 250 boilermakers from Local 659 in Warren, Pennsylvania, built the arch sections. Iron workers completed the on-site assembly. Electricians and plumbers were involved in the construction as well. According to historian Clarence Lang, the construction of the arch also became a focus of local activists' frustration by the lack of integration in federally funded construction projects. In July of 1964, Percy Green, a black activist, and Richard Daley, a white activist, scaled up 125 feet of the unfinished arch. The 29-year-old Green was the chairman of the Employment Committee for the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. As Green and Daley perched on the arch, they shut down construction that day. Other protesters held a press conference below. They demanded that 10% of the work on the project be provided to African Americans. No black workers were hired as skilled craftsmen on the project. After 4 hours, the men climbed down and were arrested. The action brought media attention to the lack of black workers, not just at the St. Louis Arch, but at construction projects throughout the nation. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Again, I come back to, you know, it's kind of ridiculous how bad our tax code is, has the pendulum swung to the favor of the very wealthy. I mean, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised when rich people spend a lot of money, like Elon Musk, $70 million, and I guess another $30 million now, on getting Trump elected, out there taking his valuable time to go out there on the stump and dance goofy, exposing himself to the reality that the rest of us should look at this guy and go, you know, run Tesla, run your business. Okay, good, you're a smart guy. You've organized things well. But, you know, this idea that they're out there for more power, more money, more influence, and most certainly, the ability to control the workforce. And as I said at the beginning, look, the fact that the Washington Post did not endorse is quite remarkable, given the fact that Trump was very clear and has been very clear about going after journalists, has been very clear of his disdain for the press. But when you stop again, as you pull back and you think about the money, the influence, the power, the contracts that come out of this, the fact that, you know, Bezos does own, you know, that space company that goes up there and lost out on a massive contract that could have given him billions of dollars, as I said, it becomes very clear that Trump is speaking to the moneyed interests in a way that he's not talking to working people. And one of the ads that's out there, and I'm not sure who's running it, is of Trump talking to the rich people going, hey, yeah, you're worth billions of dollars. I'm going to give you more. So you look at, and again, I talked about this just a minute ago, accountable.us, they've got this thing where they point out that the 15 largest corporations were massive massive beneficiaries of Trump's corporate tax giveaway. You know, and they point out that these 15 companies pocketed almost another, what was it, $97.5 billion in profits in just the first 4 years after the law passed. I mean, that's a nice savings. That's a nice pocketing. And they saw their profits skyrocket 49%. So while they didn't pay $97.5 billion into the coffers of our government, they put it in their own pockets. Their profits massively increased by 49%, which in normal times would have meant that their tax bill should have been a lot more. And as Accountable.us points out, in the first 4 years of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, Trump's corporate tax giveaway, the country's biggest, most consistently profitable corporations paid $240 billion less in taxes, seeing their effective tax rate go from 22% down to 12.8%, while again, profits rose by 44%. These are their words. And what they also find out is, surprise, surprise, they took that money and they plowed it back into what? Stock buybacks, into more dividends for the very well-to-do. It's quite remarkable that we haven't gotten the memo yet as a working class that this is what they do. And, you know, who are these big companies? You know, companies like Verizon, companies like Walmart, AT&T. These are institutional corporations. Meta, Home Depot, Intel, Comcast, Walt Disney. Across the political spectrum, Visa, Capital One Financial, Lockheed Martin, Amazon, Lowe's, UPS, United Parcel Service, and Texas Instruments. These are giant corporations who collectively spent almost, what was it, $839 billion, did I say, on stock buybacks and shareholder dividends. You want to talk about, where are my Tea Party friends? Where are my Tea Twizzlers who during 2010 and 11 were screaming, redistribution of wealth? This, my friends, massive, massive, enormous redistribution of wealth. From what should have been higher wages, better benefits, better working conditions, money being plowed back into employing new workers, using these tax breaks and these loopholes and all this stuff that we've given corporate America as sweeteners to give us employment, what have they done with that? What have they done with the power we've given them? Clearly, they've abused it in every way, shape, or form. And this is the part, this is the kicker of it. This is the instrumental part. As I told you they were going to do. As quite frankly, they told you they were going to do. And yet we still have politicians this election cycle who are out there going, we're going to give tax breaks to corporations. We're going to continue doing the same insane thing, which is giving corporate America more power, more control. And expecting, you know, maybe the rivers of honey, gold, well, what's that there? It's going to flow down on us, the trickle. It's going to trickle. Yes, it's going to trickle. It's trickling so slowly that no one notices it. And again, very predictably, when you give the very well-to-do with resources to evade taxes, additional ways to evade taxes, surprise, surprise, what do? They evade paying taxes. And you go, well, they're smart. And that's what Donald Trump would say, right? In fact, what he said about himself. He doesn't pay any taxes because he's smart. And by him being smart, what that means is you're dumb. Because you paid your taxes. You want good schools. You want safe neighborhoods. You want a country worth having. That's shame on you, suckers and losers. But here we are, election day, days away. Choice time. Time to decide which side. Which side are you on? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, that's where it goes. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Want to catch the video, freespeech.org. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.